The third level would be that alam ya'lam bi anna Allah yara.
Do you not know that Allah sees?
Yeah. Yeah. That even if these angels are not there,
and the people are not there, and you're all alone in the privacy of your home, no one is spying on you, no one is going to judge you, he's still there watching. And you know, I think one would wonder, so what, that Allah watches? It's, number one, it's his job. Number two, he can. He's the all-seeing. I mean, what am I going to do? Where am I going to hide from his sight, you know? But I think it makes it complicated when we refer ourselves to other verses of the Quran where Allah says the smallest bit of good, the smallest bit of bad is presented to them, you know, thrown back at your face.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you wonder, is this what you want to be displayed of you on the day of reckoning? Is this what you want to be reminded? Is this moment something you want to be reminded of doing once you're resurrected from the grave? I think that's what makes it complicated, you know? Because mm-hmm. if we think that we're just aimless entities, that we're created by a god, the god sees everything we do, and then we die and turn to dust. So what if the god sees us? It's his job. But if that's the thing, you turn into dust, but then you're put back together again. And everything you did is shown to you. That's when things are going to get really awkward and embarrassing.
And beyond that, so you're going to be shown.
Mm.
And so you're going to be humiliated.
Exactly.
After that, it's your eternal abode. It's
going
to last forever and ever and ever and ever. So if you're going to be end up in a good place, it's going to be forever and ever. And if it's a bad place, ever and ever. So this, whatever you make out of yourself, whatever you develop, you build out of your personality, your character, your humanity. So this is, you know, it's actually the essence of life, that this life is just but a sowing ground mm-hmm. for our next life, and we're going to sow whatever we have been putting in the ground, planting in the ground for ourselves.
And we'll reap the results of it in the hereafter.
But we keep forgetting.
We do.
And it's good to be reminded from time to time. That's why they say that go to the graveyard once in a while, once a week at least, you know, to see where you're going to end.
Mm, exactly.
And it's not so far from you. And COVID-19 has taught us a good lesson that so many people who were here not long ago are gone now. And you never know whether you're going to be here, living here in this world the next day. You know, it's good to remind ourselves.
And I think that's why the Quran refers to itself as dhikr or tadhkira, as reminder.
Exactly.
And if we look back at the whole concept of fitra, that innate, I don't want to call it nature, but again, at a loss for a better word, the English language is so restricting sometimes, that innate natural essence that we have, it was always within us. We just needed to be reminded again, you know? We got so distracted by the chaos and by the trauma and by the glitz and glamour of this material world that we kind of lost touch with our inner essence. And I think that's what's really important, to keep reminding ourselves. We're forgetful.
Yeah, that this is so true. At least it's good in the sense that if we were not forgetful, so many painful moments in our lives that have happened for all of us, it would have made us crazy into psychos, right? To know that you still remember, oh my God, even some women are like that, they actually end up getting depressed, that, did you see what she told me? Did you see what happened to me? So it's actually good that we forget, but the essence of life, we have to keep it up, you know.
Reminding ourselves.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
So far, we've said that haya is good. It's in the Quran. it should be in all parts of our lives, and whom should we, you know, have this sense of embarrassment about? Okay, so what? What am I going to do with this all information? Imagine, in other words, we want to highlight the procedure. We have been talking about the result so far, the beauties, the glamours, the benefits of having haya, the meaning of the benefits. So how can I go through a process whose end result would be a modest, chaste kind of child upbringing, or a kind of, you know, a chaste and a very virtuous family? So let's look at it from that aspect. So one point that we've been saying that in the Islamic perspective, everything starts from the mindset, right? And we said that Quran is dhikr. It's a reminder. What does it remind you of? It reminds you of certain facts. Number one, wa nafsin wa ma sawaha. First of all, it means that by the soul and him who fashioned it. So you are not like, you've been born with a soul and it's been fashioned or it's been designed in a specific way. It's been designed prior to your creation, right? It's not like it's like a jello, you just do whatever you want to do with it, right? It's like a chip that has certain potentials. If you use these potentials, good for you. If not, then you will encounter problems. Two, how has it been designed? فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَغْوَاهَا. It is inspired, you know, it can discern, it can distinguish between virtues and vices. So innately, we can understand that what is good and what is bad. This is in our soul. Number one, knowing this. Quran tells you, you human being, this is how I have created you. Know this. Two, today they have something called relativism.
Yeah.
Good. It depends. Right? Can I do this? It depends. Is it good to live with an animal? It depends. Everything depends. But in the Islamic perspective, if this nafs has been proportioned in a certain way, so no, it's not like it depends. There is a value system. And you stick to this value system. They teach you the value system. The Quran teaches you. Three, how does it teach you to, let's go back to two. How does it teach you? It tells you that whoever man amila sayyatan fala yujza illa mislaha. That there is a world, there are some good things, there are some bad things. If you do something bad, you will see the result, not only in this world, but in the world to come. The translation of the verse is that whoever commits a misdeed shall not be requited except with its like, and whoever acts righteously, whether male or female, should be faithful, they will enter paradise. So it tells you your ultimate end. What is good, what is bad, reward, punishment, ultimate end. Three, human being, mankind. Your quality is that we have certainly لَغَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. You're not like an animal. You're not like a plant. You've been
favored.
Favored. You've been chosen over the angels. God showed his, he was asking about his names and the angels couldn't answer, but Adam could, right? So you've been chosen. This is the teaching method of the Quran. Four, you're being washed all the time. Imagine you put into your mind all this kind of information. And five, okay, I'm being watched. I know my value system. I know that I have a specific soul. There are role models. Other people have paved the way. Other people have gone through this way and they have made it easy for you. It's not like where am I going? What am I supposed to do?
A state of constant bewilderment. It's not like that.
Exactly. You know exactly what to do, in whose footsteps to put your foot. So in the Inshallah, in our next episode, we will talk about some of the role models that we have been given, specifically with regards to the topic of haya and modesty.
Inshallah ta'ala. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the loved one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Apparently in the UK, the COVID-19 virus has mutated into a different strain, one that is much more powerful and a more transmissible strain. Matt Hancock, the UK's health minister, said a new variant of the virus is up to 70% more transmissible was getting out of control.
I understand they're coming down in November, but you could have predicted that they might be going back up again in 4 weeks' time. This is an extremely unpredictable virus.
Well, as you say, it's very unpredictable. And
why did you make that promise?
Well, it's very unpredictable because we understand, I understand, how important Christmas is to people who've been looking forward to it all year.
In England at present, some 17 million people are under Tier 4 rules. That's the highest level where people are being told to stay at home and not to leave the area.
And I'm off oxygen, feeling stronger all the time, you know. Still quite emotional. It's frightening.
People don't realise what's going on in here. If they don't see it firsthand, they won't know. They think everything's hunky-dory. It's not.
The dark red area, London and the South East, is in Tier 4 with the toughest restrictions because of the spread of the variant of the virus. Orange shows those parts of England in Tier 2, some of which are bordering that Tier 4 block.
Our political editor, Gary Gibbon, is in Westminster. Gary.
Well, on the specific problem of truck drivers being able to get into France, the government really does feel that an easing of that problem, if not a complete solution, is on the way.
To make matters worse, researchers in the UK believe that there are going to be even more difficult times ahead for Britons.
but I think that we are in strict measures for some weeks to come. We absolutely need to try and get the R number below one, at least in most regions of the UK, and it's well above that now. So I think we need to recognise that January and well into February are going to be very difficult.
The number of people that have tested positive for the virus in the UK has increased to record highs despite the rollout of a vaccine. With the recent surge in COVID-19 cases, London began to reactivate its emergency field hospitals, known as Nightingale Hospitals, to cope with the crisis.
A realistic timeline that things will be much better by late spring. But of course, this is a global pandemic and we want to vaccinate in all countries of the world. So keeping an eye on international travel and how we move around the globe is going to be very important well into 2022, actually, just until we're confident about vaccination levels in a range of different countries.
Aside from the mutation of the virus, experts believe that there was also another underlying issue that has contributed to the high death toll there. The recent record UK COVID-19 death rate is being blamed on pre-existing inequality. Pre-existing social inequalities contributed to the UK recording the highest death rates from COVID-19 in Europe, according to a new report titled Build Back Fairer. The report is written by Michael Marmot, a professor of epidemiology at University College London, director of the UCL Institute of Health Equity, and past president of the World Medical Association. The report says that families at the bottom of the social and economic scale were missing out before the pandemic and were now suffering even more, losing health, jobs, lives, and educational opportunities. According to the report, men and women living in overcrowded conditions in the most deprived areas of the country are the most likely to die from COVID. Carers and those who work in the leisure and service industries have the highest death rates under the age of 64. People from Black, Asian and ethnic minority groups who work as taxi drivers, bus drivers, security guards, carers and other low-paid occupations have a higher risk of death. Children and young people living in deprived areas had suffered disproportionately from lockdown. Previous policy by the UK government have contributed to this inequality, including cutting the budget for Public Health England in 2012 by 40%, and the spending on public health in local government was cut by about $1.10 billion. This has compounded the dire situation in the UK. The UK never recovered from its first wave of the coronavirus. Millions have lost their jobs since the beginning of 2020. One in 20 people in the UK had already lost their jobs due to the coronavirus when YouGov conducted a poll back in April of 2020. Also, applications for Universal Credit, the government's benefit system, are sky high, with nearly 500,000 claims in 9 days as of last week. This has left many Britons forced to take handouts from charities to satisfy their hunger.
I had half a bag of rice and a tub of butter because I hadn't been able to go out and do my food shopping. This really helped me out because I was thinking, when's my next meal going to be, or when am I going to be able to go out and get any food shopping?
Many are also left without money to pay their rent and now face evictions.
To come through this and then you don't suddenly stop wages coming in my account and I'm like, whoa, what am I gonna do now? Landlord, why I wanna say landlord, you might keep me for 3 months. After 3 months, you ain't gonna keep me. You kick me out. They ain't gonna bother about this coronavirus and stuff. You don't pay, you don't stay.
Now charities believe that there is going to be a lot more people in need of help as the new coronavirus strain takes its toll.
Trying to see a lot more people that we never maybe considered as vulnerable before, now needing that food. And some of those people potentially were previously what was classed as the working poor. There were a lot of households where even though everyone in that household worked, they were still struggling to put food on the table. So to now not have that income means that we're going to see a lot of people in crisis that we just wouldn't expect to see before.
In fact, a report by the Public Health England published in August 2020 found that the COVID-19 was spreading faster in those living in the more deprived areas than those living in the least deprived areas. This means that these people who were in need are even more needier now, living in circumstances they wouldn't have thought of. This is especially true with the rising COVID-19 crisis there.
I mean, as we're going out and we're delivering the food, you can feel the desperation with some families that are, so, you know, so needy at the moment. And things are only going to get worse as time goes on. I know that the self-employed are not going to get anything from the government until about June. I mean, what about those people? They're going to need food on their tables. I just think it's going to get more and more intense.
While it is too early to predict the true economic consequences of Britain's departure from the single market, already there are signs that the country's fragile food system will need to be rapidly updated in order to protect families, especially those on lower incomes. And now with Brexit, researchers expect tragic rise in food prices and increased inequality in the UK. The amount of food distributed by the charity organisation Trussell Trust, which runs around 1,200 of the country's 2,000 food banks, rose 73% in the past 5 years, with around 500,000 emergency food supplies going to children last year. Worst of all, inequality, the fundamental problem of the rising COVID-19 death rate in the UK, is growing too. Compared to other developed countries, the UK has a very unequal distribution of income. Almost a quarter of all household wealth in the UK is held by the richest 1% of the population, according to alarming new research by the Office for National Statistics, with data from the Sunday Times Rich List. The study reveals a historic underestimation of inequality in the country. As the country faces its biggest crisis since World War II, for millions of people, the government's financial aid will be too little, too late.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
O
آقای آمد خدمت پیغمبر اکرم، یا رسول الله اذنی موعظم کن. فرمود گوش میدی موعظت کنم و الا.
Once a person came to Prophet Muhammad and asked him to give him some pieces of advice. Prophet Muhammad for three times asked that man, "Are you absolutely ready to listen to my advice?" The man replied, "Yes, the Prophet of Allah." The Prophet stated, "Think deeply before doing anything in your life, because haste in action will bring regrets." From this statement of Prophet Muhammad, we understand that haste in action will have consequences, even if it is a religious matter. Sometimes haste in religious matters will lead to polytheism. We have to be more patient so that when the right moment and place come, Allah gives the answer to our calls. The opposite of haste is tasabbut, which means to do the things based on deep thoughts and preciseness. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the things that he did at that time for this revolution, if today we can say, like, if Iran has the constitution today, it's because of the hard working of Shahid Beheshti, the dedication that he had on this work.
This is a natural principle, that people are affected by the rulers.
One thing very obvious about his character that made him more influential was his management skills. Not only management skills, but in the more modern sense of it, leadership qualities. He was truly a leader. And when it came to him actually leading the whole group of scholars who were working on the Iranian constitution, you can see the high capability of these persons.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and Dr. Zazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Good to be here.
So in the new series of the program, The Teacher, we have started discussing the thoughts and speeches of Sayyid Muhammad Husseini Beheshti, mainly known as Shahid Beheshti in Iran. We know that he was one of the greatest jurists, philosophers and thinkers of contemporary Iran, who was assassinated, unfortunately, at the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. As usual, we play one Persian audio file of this great scholar, and then we'll discuss content of his speech. Let's listen to this Persian audio file, along with the English translation, and then we'll continue our discussion.
Ma'ad yani tak tak ma insan ha.
Resurrection denotes a day when every one of us, after death, will face an infinite period of existence, by when every single human being has to come up against all their good and bad deeds they committed before their demise. Resurrection for us is not a matter of monotheistic free society or multi-class society. That multi-class society is the hell, and monotheistic free society the same heaven? No. This is not what the Quran introduces as heaven and hell. A multi-class society is terribly ugly, rejected, and just like the hell, but it is not the hell described in the Quran. A monotheistic free society is so beautiful and similar to heaven, but not the real heaven. We believe in resurrection as to be for every single human being. Everyone will face resurrection, and not that the whole society will move in a historical process to reach the heaven or that monotheistic free society. And that first one is the true resurrection for humanity.
What you listened to was Shahid Beheshti regarding the topic of Ma'ad. This is the third episode on the concept of Ma'ad. Since it is very controversial and complicated, we try to discuss it in detail with the presence of Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Okay, Dr. Zazadeh, a very important question, and what Shahid Beheshti also is referring to, is a society without classes. I mean, he criticized this concept and this thought that a society without classes is not the heaven that we are talking about after the phase of Ma'ad or resurrection. Now, the question is, nowadays in the 21st century, we see so many people looking for their rights. We can say from the women to the young to the black to the colored people. Minorities in different countries are looking for their rights. And this shows that a society with class exists. The people whose payments are lower than the other ones, or the justice is not at all observed in the payments or the wages among the people of the society. Now, my question is this. how the concept of ma'ad would help us in removing the concept of discrimination from a society. We know that Shahid Beheshti says discrimination among the classes of the society, removing it does not mean ma'ad. But at the same time, how we can use the concept of ma'ad to remove discrimination in a society?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, in order to answer this question, let me use a hadith from the Holy Prophet, a very famous hadith that maybe all of us have heard, but it's really a very profound saying that we need to reflect on that very much. Even Shahid Athani, the great scholar, Zainuddin Muhammad,
known as Shahid Athani,
and he's one of the greatest scholars in the Shi'i history, in the Islamic history in general, we can say, has an independent treatise on this very hadith. That hadith says, "Ad-dunya mazra'atul akhirah." Mm-hmm. You know, this world is a farm for the other world.
Okay.
Because it sounds to be very clear, but it has so many implications that if people want to know more about it, they should refer to that book. But if I want to answer your question based on this hadith, we say, yes, you know, we have some good concepts or good, let's say, good deeds or good actions or good, let's say, ideals that we want them to happen in our society or in ourselves.
That's right.
If we want to give a good, let's say, motive for those things to happen in the society, we really need to pay attention to this hadith. Every single action that we do, every single thing that happens in this world, is like a seed that we plant in our farm. So if you are working on making this society a better society, a society which is free from any discrimination, we really need to always have in mind that you are working in the way of God.
Okay.
That is, I think, the only way that we can actually connect these two concepts.
Uh-huh.
Making a society which is free from discrimination, making a society which is based on justice, is one of the best deeds that a person can do, society can actually pursue. So if we are doing that, actually we are making a better situation for ourselves in the future. But again, I want to just say that we should not limit the concept of ma'ad to this worldly life, to making a class-free society.
That's right. Because whenever we are talking about the paradise and the hell and the heaven, the first thing that comes to our mind is the other world.
Yes.
The other world. And this has its own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
I think the concept of ma'ad is very much limited to the other world. We do not think and we do not have this ma'ad type of thinking in our daily lives. I mean, if we want to have a society full of justice or without any discrimination, this concept of ma'ad, thinking about the consequences and the results of our actions in the other world, can help us very much. But the modern movements are limiting themselves to some criterion, standards, and constitutions that are only applicable to the physical world and not the other world.
Yes.
This is what point was regarding this question.
You're right. And, you know, if people think that way, I mean, in a proper way, so that they do not forget the other world, they will be much more motivated to work for
making
a better society in this world.
Okay.
Let's imagine this. I mean, two different case scenarios. One is that we do our best in order to achieve something in this very short physical life that we have.
Right.
The second case scenario is that we do the same good thing, but in order to achieve something in this world and in the other world, in order to achieve something which is endless, which is limitless, which will be rewarded in another world in addition to what we gain in this world. So, I mean, naturally, logically, in which of these case scenarios will be more motivated to work for? Definitely when I see that I gain more for the same thing with just being mindful of the other world, that will give me much more motive to work for that.
And these are the problems, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, we are facing nowadays in the world. War everywhere. We can say looking for more wealth, the money, dollars, you know. I don't know, stock markets and how can I say, sorry to say, rape. And all these, we can say, the powers and the anger that exists in today's world. At the same time,
the people are looking for the solutions in the same field. I mean, the same physical, constitutional field that they're looking for their rights. But I think Ma'at can help us very much in this regard, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that is true. Obviously, Ma'at, then it reminds you of the hereafter. And when you know that you're accountable for what you have done in hereafter, you will be very much careful.
Right.
In the Quran, Surah Al-Zalzalah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَى. Whoever does the good and atoms weight will see it. وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَةٍ شَرًّا يَرَى. And whoever does ill and atoms weight will see it.
Okay.
So if we have this ma'ad in our daily life, we need to remember. That's why, you know, in the Islam, it is recommended to go and visit the graves of family members, obviously, who passed away.
The deceased ones, that's
right. The deceased ones. Why? Because when you go there, you will know that, after all, I have to come here.
Mm-hmm.
This is my last destination in this world.
That's right.
Whatever I have, the money, the wealth, the children, everyone will remain in this world.
That's right.
And the only thing which I will have, obviously, this grave and my body and my soul will transfer to another world. On top of that, you know, when we are talking about the class-free society, we need to define what does this class-free society means.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a worldly meaning of this class-free society and there is a Quranic meaning.
Mm-hmm.
In both ways, obviously, in the Quran, even in the Ma'ad, we see classes as well. Why? Because the prophets, they are the leaders.
Okay.
The A'imma, the saints, they are the leaders. And we will be obviously gathered with them, and they will be the leaders over there as well. So there is a class, obviously, in the Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, like, the one who knows and the one who does not know, they're not equal.
That's right.
The one who does the good deed and the bad deed, they're not the equal.
That's right.
Inna akramakum inda Allahi atqakum.
That's right.
The one who is near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who is the pious one,
okay,
who God varies. So there is a class, obviously. Someone who have less taqwa, for example, is not equal to one who has the more taqwa. Yes, there is a definition of Quranic, like the Quranic definition of classes that has been said. In this world, we can see, obviously, there is a master, there is a leader in the shape of a prophet or imam. And there are the rest who are following them. They're not the equal. There is a class there. But on top of that, we can see the same leader is living like the poorest person in the world, in the society.
Okay.
So this discrimination of worldly, we can say, like, or material, we can say, status, that is not seen in the eyes of Quran or in the eyes of Allah or in the Ma'ad, in the hereafter. The actual thing is your deeds. You will be divided into different classes because of your deeds,
mm-hmm,
on the basis of your taqwa that you have.
But these classes,
but not these classes that you have money, so you will get the better place in the paradise, or maybe you can do the confession.
Or these classes or tabaqa that are given by social movements to you. No, it is not. It is not the criteria.
It is not the criteria. It is not the criteria. Maybe there is a person who have nothing, but his deeds are
in the eyes of Allah.
In the eyes of Allah, he is the most atqaqum.
As happened about Prophet Muhammad, you know, at his time there were so many wealthy people around him, but he was given the best class of the society.
And
And
the main point, like with the Jews or the Bani Israel, obviously they had the fight. They said, we are the afdal, for example, the greaters of the mankind.
Yeah.
Why Allah did not send a prophet from amongst us?
We are the
nobles. You know, the battle of Khaybar that happened, and the Jews, why this was happening is because they were thinking like the prophet should come from the Jews, not the sons of we can say like Ismail alayhi salam. Obviously, there were two sons of the Ishaq and Ismail, the sons of Ibrahim alayhi salam. So, you know, these are the thinking, this material thinking that we have in this world.
Okay.
And the problems that we have and why we are looking for the solutions materially, it's because there is an hadith, An-nasu ala dini mulukihi.
That's right.
That the people are following the religion of their, like,
leaders.
Their leaders or the rich people.
That's all right.
They look at the rich people, what they are doing. That's why, you know, whenever we had a king in a country being a Muslim, the country was, for example, the territory was Muslim. Yes. It was a Christian. We had these crusade wars and all those things.
Okay.
These are because of this.
Okay.
So we need to go beyond this world,
material,
and look for the solutions beyond this.
Thank you much, Dr. Reza Zadan Said Mousanawi, for a fruitful discussion regarding the concept of Ma'ad. This was our third episode regarding the concept of Ma'ad according to one speech, one part of this speech of Shaheed Ayatollah Beheshti. It was very kind of you and dear listeners. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. You can download for free our other episodes of this program on our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also visit our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, also shaped all our tomorrows. This program is about the life and times, the biographical account of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him and may his soul rest in peace. The leader, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran. And, of course, we are going through the second phase of the life and times of Imam Khomeini, and this is in regard to his exile back in 1963. And with me in the studio to discuss that very phase is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum, a very renowned scholar. Salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyidina. And thank you very much for giving us your valuable time today.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. Sayyidina, we were at that point discussing about some of the great characteristics and virtues of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his and rest his soul. We were talking about the fact that he was very determined to deal with the situation here in Iran, because certainly in terms of the oppression from the Pahlavi regime. And we're now talking about, of course, Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza's father, who was installed since the 1920s, as you mentioned before. And, of course, he was trying to promote an agenda which was very similar to that of Atatürk we discussed in Turkey, where he was trying to secularize Iran and remove religion from the people. But he was doing it in such a way that there was a considerable oppression of the clergy in particular. So we moved to the 60s, and we were mentioning about the fact that since the time of Mossadegh, since in 1953, where Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani's movement in terms of nationalizing the oil industry, about trying to make it a republic or an Islamic republic. But the movement didn't last. It was the coup d'etat done by the CIA, by the Americans, established the son of Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza Pahlavi, as the ultimate and king of kings, we can say, of the region, not only of Iran, but of the entire Middle East. And, of course, they had, through him, strengthened their relations with the Zionist regime, because we know that round about this time, of course, you know, the Arabs were having their Yom Kippur War, as they called it, with Egypt. And, of course, Iran was helping the Zionist regime at that time through the Reza Shah Pahlavi. And, of course, Imam Khomeini spoke out about that. I mean, he certainly was, you know, these were the things that he was highlighting to the public, that, you know, here we are supporting the very enemy of Islam in the heartland of the region. So we're now on to the second phase where, you know, the Shah has, you know, after that very powerful speech that he gave in the Fezia, the Hawza here in Qum, And, you know, the soldiers went in and, you know, we know of the atrocities that were then committed in the Hawza Fezzi, where, you know, clergy were literally thrown off the rooftops and were martyred. And, you know, the whole Hawza Fezzi was ransacked by the soldiers. And, of course, as you see, within a couple of days, Imam Khomeini was sent out of Iran. So I'd like you to speak now a bit about the exile, about this very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, especially the 14 years in Najaf, where he was participating in the Grand Hawza there, giving lectures and seminars on his own right, because we now discuss the fact that he was also a Marja'i Taqlid as well. So could you enlighten us further as to what that phase of his life was about and how important it was in shaping future events?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In fact, the events of Fezia, which were pertaining to Imam's initial removal from Qom, because he didn't right from the outset be removed from Qom and Iran. He was in fact taken out of Qom
right.
and passed from pillar to post to different prisons and things
right.
in
Iran. Right, okay, so there was the prison
imprisonment and people's revolts and
sure.
people's want for him to be released and so on.
Yes,
I mean, after 19 days after the events of Ashura, which was on the 6th of June, which is known as the regular Khodad demonstrations and things which take place
right.
on the 14th of Khodad,
right.
a regular event which is renowned here. As of that particular event on the 3rd of June 1963,
right.
he was taken away after that event
right.
and imprisoned. I mean, 19 days afterwards, he was imprisoned in Khalsa prison.
Right.
And thereupon, he was moved to different places.
This prison was in Tehran, was it?
It is in Tehran.
Yeah,
and then he was taken to a military base where he was kept
right.
for a while.
Right.
So this whole process of him being back in Qom and away type of thing,
right.
it took a whole of almost 5 months.
Right.
It was from the 3rd of June till the 4th of November, 64. In fact, 1 year and 5 months.
Right.
A whole 1 year had taken place over
right,
that
right.
Process of time. And you see Imam Khomeini, and there are a lot of riots and demonstrations taking place for his release. And at the final straw was August of 1964, when Shah was continuing to make pro-American gestures.
Of course,
pro-American gestures,
yep.
and particularly in autumn of 1964, when they passed the law that an American person could even kill an Iranian, but he would not be judged here in Iran; he would have to go to America.
Sure.
That Imam Khomeini made his final bash for the Shah of that time. You know,
yeah. And this also comes with the backdrop that, of course, the Pahlavi regime in 1961, under the auspices of John F. Kennedy at the time,
yeah.
under that administration, he was bringing in the so-called White Revolution.
Indeed, that yeah. White Revolution, in fact, they again used it against the ulema.
Yes, it was against the clergy.
The clergies were against the White Revolution. The White Revolution was trying to give the ordinary man an opportunity, whilst the ulema were working with big people and gangsters, so to say, of the time, and they were kind of trying to tune public against them.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing which Imam Khomeini did have a strong word for was this thing about the Americans who could commit crimes in Iran against the Iranian people
mm-hmm.
and have impunity in reality.
Yeah, it was complete immunity.
Immunity and released from mm-hmm. any. To the fact that Imam Khomeini said that a cook of the American embassy could come and kick the Shah in the teeth and the Shah could not do anything
about it.
Yeah. You know, so as to say, you know, the most petite personnel of the American embassy could do whatever
complete
they could
humiliation.
With the absolute authority of Iran.
Sure,
so you
sure.
can see Imam Khomeini was really out for it on this, on
yeah.
this particular issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Majlis was really keen to have it going. The Parliament
of
America
yeah.
of Iran, which was obviously fully dominated by pro-American, pro-Western stooges of the Shah,
sure.
and of course their own personal kickbacks that they as politicians were getting,
sure.
Were out to make this law permanent.
Yes, I mean the Majlis's function at that time was simply to ratify whatever the Shah had to
Indeed.
Say.
Yeah. Indeed. So whilst in autumn of 64 this was going on and Imam
sure.
Khomeini was making his stand against it, this was the last tour for the Shah. Right. He gets him arrested in 1964, 4th of November. Right. And the following, or on that same day, or the morning of that day, whatever it may be, he was taken to the airport and sent off to Turkey.
Turkey, yes.
And there he was looked after in Turkey by a Turkish general. Mm. And, of course, why Turkey was selected was because of the fact that Shah hoped that because Turkey had no ulema ruled there.
That's
in the
right.
sense ulema could not walk around with their turban or religious symbols or anything, that his whole concept would subdue there and cease to exist.
Well, there's a black and white photograph of Imam Khomeini wandering around in Istanbul, and he's just wearing an overcoat, and there's no religious regalia
indeed.
Of any kind.
Indeed. Yeah. And that's what his aspiration was, that in this process of time, in his exile in Turkey...
Yeah, this will pacify him somehow.
He'll die out, in the sense the whole concept of Imam Khomeini stand against...
But then circumstances changed, didn't they?
Indeed, circumstances changed because Imam Khomeini wanted to be back into his lecturing capacity, wanted to be back with the ulema of the time, wanted to be in the schools and be teaching.
Back into Hoza again,
indeed,
of course.
Teaching whoever he felt were able to be his future idealists.
Right.
Of the
so
future.
How did he manage to get back to
Najaf?
Well,
what happened in that that on the 5th of September 65? I mean, he didn't stay in Turkey
for long, hardly
a year.
Right.
He leaves Turkey and goes off for Najaf. Where he spends the next 13 years of his time.
That's right.
So this 14 years exile is a year, just under a year in Turkey, and then the rest of the 13 years
is
in
Iraq.
Right. And of course, not as such in Iraq, in the sense he's then forced out by Iraq in the latter part of the 70s, where he's in Kuwait and then goes off to France.
Sure.
But that's a whole story in itself.
Itself, yes, of course. Of course.
The last year is that very important phase of his pre-revolution phase.
It's interesting that he's coming into Najaf at the backdrop of one of the most cruel coups in Iraq at that time, which was the coming of the Ba'athist regime in 1958. And, you know, he's coming at a backdrop of this murderous regime that comes in. I mean, how does he manage to survive that exile there?
This is Islamic history.
Yeah.
You see, you had Imam Muhammad Baqir al-Islam and Imam Jafar Sadiq al-Islam being the best promoters of the fiqh of the Shiite opinion during the time when the Bani Abbasis and the Bani Umayyah are fighting for it. You know, so that fight of the enemy gives the opportunity for the best to come out.
That's right.
You know, they're fighting amongst themselves. What happened when Imam Khomeini settled himself in Najaf? He started teaching in Sheikh Ansari's madrasa. Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, who's a very prominent. In fact, Sheikh Ansari changed the whole principles of fiqh. And laid down very important principles of jurisprudence in his own time.
Right.
And that madrasa was obviously quite a prominent madrasa within the Shia community's theological teachings.
I mean, this is the elite we are talking about here in Najaf. Yes.
So he settles in there and starts delivering lectures of various types, both jurisprudential lectures, as well as the fact that very principle that he wants to set up a future identity of Islamic movement,
a future identity of Islamic
society.
Yeah.
You see, what was very important in these this period of time is not only is Imam Khomeini promoting the whole concept of Shia teaching, but he's also interpreting it to be a practically performed theory for the people.
Yes,
you know, it's not just an ordinary theory of the books.
It was a practical outline of how it was going to work.
Indeed.
Yeah.
He was trying to put to work all those Islamic theories into a practical application for the people.
Exactly.
So what he was really trying to do was he was trying to put the theories into a definition of what we as a layman would say, political application of religion.
Right.
And that was very important, what Imam Khomeini, because from the outset, Imam Khomeini had been in the political arena of what was happening, even though the enemies, his enemies have always endeavored to say, why don't you stay in the mosque? Why don't you stay in the madrasas? Why don't you just do the teaching? He had always been out front line. Taking on political issues which were affecting the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you see what the enemies of the Islamic movement have always tried to do is to separate politics from religion. Imam Khomeini dragged it in, screaming and shouting, so as to say, the word politics into religion, even though the enemies attempted to pull it out.
As you quite rightly say, Imam Khomeini was unique in that sense that he comes out as a firebrand with simply pointing out the fact it's not Islam. You know, if we're not talking about politics, we're not talking about Islam at all.
No, I mean, he's one of the main things that